Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. My guest today is Nancy Scheer, once a 15-year-old sneaking into Philadelphia Orchestra concerts, and then by 18, she was the musical assistant to Leopold Stokowski. She's now a celebrated writer, lecturer, and commentator in the world of classical music, and in her memoir, I Knew a Man Who Knew Brahms, she reveals an insider's perspective full of genius and idiosyncrasy and containing tales both touching and trenchant. And intriguingly, the man who knew Brahms isn't the Grand Maestro after all. So that adds a poetic twist to a memoir filled with wonder and remembrance. I Knew a Man Who Knew Brahms is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Nancy Scheer, go to nancyscheer.com. And Nancy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be with you.
Thank you. How did you get initially into that world of classical music? Because the typical teenager is involved in usually, rock or getting into trouble or something in between. How did you get into that world?
I also, just across the room here, I'm in my studio. I also have my LP, Elvis's Golden Records. So I did not miss out on that great rock and roll.
Good for
so
you.
So that was a part of my life too.
Excellent. But well-rounded.
Somebody gave me a ticket at school, a free ticket to the Philadelphia Orchestra when I was 15 years old. And I used that ticket and got in on a Friday afternoon, and the experience was so visceral, so powerful, so emotional for me that I had to go back the following week. And I did. I just didn't have a dollar and a quarter for the ticket. And I just stood there, and this lovely person at the box office wrote out, I guess she just felt sorry for me. She wrote out a little form and signed her name and handed it to me. And that got me into the cheapest seat all the way up in what they call the peanut gallery,
yes,
the amphitheater. And I decided to come back every week, and she gave me a pass until finally she said, I can't keep doing this. I'm going to get in trouble. So she says, why don't you stand over across the lobby? It was a beautiful lobby where all the women, because their husbands were working at that time, this was 1960s, she said, stand there because some of these women buy two subscriptions and their husbands don't come. And some of them might like to have you as company. And I did. I stood there and somebody came over for a couple of weeks and said, would you like a ticket? And I got into the most expensive location in the Academy of Music in Philadelphia with the Philadelphia Orchestra. And then that stopped working. So I kept thinking, how can I get into that building? And I remembered that there was an entrance around the corner that happened to be the stage door. And I stood there for a while, and I not only eventually got in, but the conductor of the orchestra, Eugene Ormandy, took pity on me, brought me back to his office. And 2 years later, after I had discovered the Philadelphia Orchestra Library and become very intrigued with what the librarians were doing, they hired me. I became a member of the Philadelphia Orchestra library staff. I was not an assistant. I was assistant to the librarian. And it was a beautiful time of my life, just hearing all the rehearsals and the concerts. So that's how I got in. It was initially through a fund that provided free tickets for young people.
What is it about classical music? And I want to particularly ask you that question, because listeners and viewers of a certain age would not necessarily be exposed to classical music. And I want them to understand that there's an emotional connection for many in the world of classical music. But what was it for you?
It's a very powerful emotional connection. And I remember feeling it in my body. It was that powerful. It elicited that kind of an emotional response. But classical music it requires some attention. And there are times when a piece will not let you alone. If you have music on as background and you're doing something where it's so powerful that you will not be able to continue reading the newspaper or my book or doing something else, but you will be powerfully drawn to whatever you're listening to. But then there are other times with classical music where it's quieter and it's a little more subtle and it does demand your attention. And not everybody in our crazy world, whether they're young or older, wants to give that kind of attention to something, to detail. You know, we're living in an age where I just heard something about the attention span used to be 9 seconds. Now it's 4 seconds.
Right.
And you're being pulled in all kinds of directions with the cell phone and your email and internet, all kinds of things. With classical music, it's really lovely to give it your full attention and allow it to speak to you.
Would you say it's also a form of meditation in today's world if you were to set yourself aside and listen to something by Brahms, for example? So it's part of the title of the book, I Knew a Man Who Knew Brahms, by Nancy Scheer. Is that, in a way, a form of meditation? You're tuned in to a universe that is not typically listened to in daily life, in modern daily life.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I never thought of it that way, but I think you're right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you.
I think you're right.
I came up with an idea. Your charisma is fascinating because you've been able to interact with some major figures in the world of classical music. Yeah. Was there one particular, well, I already know the answer, but I'm going to let you answer it. One particular person that influenced you the most. And if you can give us an example of how that influence impacted you in your life or your career or both.
In everything, really. And that was Leopold Stokowski, who was a powerfully attractive figure, tremendous charisma. He just defined the word. And he would walk out on stage. He was 6'2", and he had this flowing white hair and this heroic profile and his posture. And he would come out on stage, and he owned that concert hall. Everybody, 3,000 people or more in that concert hall, were just under his power. A lot of people will remember him from the movie Fantasia, because he was the one who not only conducted the orchestra, but he was the person who bent down at some point and Mickey Mouse climbed up on the podium and he tugged at Stokowski's pants and Stokowski turned around and, "Hello, Mickey." And Mickey Mouse raised his hand and Stokowski and he shook hands. And that's been a sort of not just a claim to fame, but also a point of reference for, I guess, an entire generation who saw Fantasia when it was originally released in 1940. And all these years later, there's going to be a special showing at Film Forum in New York on September 28th, which I'm actually going to introduce. But all these years later, we're talking about 85 years.
Right.
And Fantasia is still making a mark with people who have seen a lot more dramatic visuals, because today it's a very visual time, and special effects. And this was way before special effects. It was all animated. But Stokowski, to me, represented freedom and an intense expressiveness and a lot of romanticism. And I mean that in the true word of the romantic era. But just this eloquence on the podium, and you could immediately tell the difference from Stokowski conducting to someone else who was a more controlled, a drier sound, not quite as effusive emotionally. Not everybody liked what Stokowski did, and I really respect that. I not only loved it then, many, many years later, I still do, and it's still a touchstone for me in my life.
And two, there was in your book, there are photos, and there's one where you visit him after he's retired, and you took a picture with him.
Never retired.
Oh, I take it back then. Okay.
Never, never.
Well, let me rephrase it, Your Honor. He retired from the orchestra. Would that be fair?
He left the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Yeah, that I guess that's the term then. He left.
Yeah, but he continued doing a lot of things after that.
I stand corrected, which I always like to do, or sit in this case, but either way is good. What was it? I want to go back to Fantasia for just a second, because we tend to think of classical music conductors particularly as serious people, and yet he was in, here he is with Mickey Mouse in Fantasia. So there was, I think at that moment, there was a whole different view of him based on that.
Oh, he took terrible criticism for doing that. Terrible. From the musical, mostly from the musical community. And a lot of people said, he's taking serious classical music into Hollywood. Oh, you didn't do that. I mean, you paid a, your reputation paid a price for that. And he did, but he was adamant about bringing classical music to the masses. But yeah, he paid a price for it. And, you know, that's what I'm hoping will just kind of disappear, and people will realize classical music can be anywhere. You can listen to it absolutely anywhere. But he was the one who said, let's just open this up and take it to the entire world.
When you have a conversation with all of these greats in the classical music world that you experienced, was there one a threaded theme throughout? What I mean by that is, maybe my choice of words is not right, but is there something that's very similar to all the conductors, the great ones as well as the okay ones, but there's something about that's a similar theme to their approach to music, their approach to working with other musicians, etc.?
That's a really interesting question. I would hope that it, that thread would be a love of music. And another part of the thread was serving the composer. That these conductors, their job was not just to make interesting music and vibrant music or appealing music, but it was to give to the audience, through what they did with the orchestra players, what the composer wanted. Because the composer, you know, they're long gone. And some of them for a very long time. So to bring that music to life just through markings on paper, that's what was in front of these players, was this paper stuff that had little black markings on it. And that's what Stokowski was against. He'd say, oh, that music is just black marks on a paper until it's brought to life. So most of the conductors I worked with, they were focused on doing what the composer wanted. Stokowski was not as much as other composers. He just wanted to bring it to life with the drama that he felt the music should express. And that's what was important to him. So he wasn't quite as tied into staying with what the composer wanted. And again, he got a lot of criticism for that. Mm-hmm. But I shouldn't have thought this, but I thought it was wonderful. And here I was at his librarian, and sometimes he'd change the markings, which even today, you're not supposed to do that. But he did. He felt that it should have as much color and drama as the music deserved. I've got some really interesting examples in my book. There was one of Richard Strauss's tone poem, Till Eulenspiegel. And he stopped the Philadelphia Orchestra. I think it was Philadelphia. In a rehearsal, and he was furious. He says, no, no. He says, you're playing this music too clearly, too much exactly by the note. He said, this is Till falling down. He falls into a river. He said, that's what this music represents. So he didn't want it to be exact. He just wanted it to be free and to represent this character falling down into the river. And then there was another time, I think also with Philadelphia, well, this was with Philly, where he was performing the Firebird Suite. And there's one section where there's a run, which is a sequence of notes going from low to high. And it was a blur. And that's how I've always heard it. And that's fine. That's pretty much what Strauss wrote. And Stokowski stopped the orchestra and he said, no, he said, it's just a blur of sound. He slowed it down so much that you could hear every one of the individual notes in that brum, bum, bum, bum. He slowed it down. So you would hear every one. And then he took it back up to tempo. He speeded it up a bit, but you could still hear. I get chills. You know, I'm talking about 60 years later. I'm sitting here with you and I'm getting chills. And he slowed it down and then speeded it up a bit, but you could still hear that wonderful rainbow of color in the individual tones. And that's what I love in music, is that kind of attention to detail. And then when it serves the drama, the music best, you don't pay attention as much to the detail as you do to the overall effect.
Right.
It's drama.
And would you say that a lot of classical music, and I'm probably, this is going to sound like a silly question in a way, but we referenced it earlier in our conversation, a lot of classical music is designed to stir the emotion of people. It's not just to listen to.
Some is not as much. It's more of, in a way, an intellectual experience. And, you know, in the 1960s, a lot of music that was being composed, what we call 12-tone music, atonal music, and it shunned melody. There was not as much melodic content in those works as there was in the Romantic era. I mean, all morning, I've had the Tchaikovsky Symphony No. 5 playing inside my head, and I don't know why. And I didn't particularly want to listen to it this morning, but it decided it was going to play. And I'm listening to the whole thing. I'm listening to the orchestra, and I can hear the horns. I can hear the strings. And some of those melodies have even been adapted as song, as melodies of commercial songs. In the 1960s, that stopped a bit because the composers were not paying as much attention to melody. And there was a gap that formed between audiences and the music of our time. And it's really the first time that people were not listening to what we call contemporary music, is really music of your time. So you hope that it's going to stir the emotions and live inside people's hearts and their souls and their minds, but not all of it does. But the fun is to listen to as much as you can and see what appeals to you. And, you know, if it's being performed by a great symphony orchestra and a great conductor and a great soloist, that doesn't mean that it's going to appeal to everybody. And anyone who doesn't like it has to really be free to say, you know something, it may be great to these orchestra people, it may be great to the conductor, but I personally don't like it. That is 100% valid, and nobody should ever feel ashamed of saying that. That's just a fact, and they are entitled to their opinion as much as a professional musician is.
I know that in decades ago, there used to be quite a few classical music stations in major markets. I'm thinking particularly in Los Angeles, where I grew up, KFAC. And that disappeared over time, and probably the same in most other markets in the United States. Are you concerned about the decline in, not classical music, but getting the word out and playing classical music on a mass basis? In other words, we're kind of in our own silos these days with the way we can program our own music and listen to it without, we don't really actually need radio stations anymore. So we can choose to do it. But how do you get the word out? And then I want to talk a little bit more about your book, which again is called I Knew a Man Who Knew Brahms. But I wonder, how do you get the word out if people are in their silos listening a particular, you mentioned Elvis, if you're just going to hear Elvis and that's what you put on your iPhone, as opposed to being exposed to other forms of music? It's how do you promote classical music in today's world, given the technology, and it's not set up for mass distribution as it was many years ago.
It's getting harder and harder. And it's been in that condition now, I would say 30 years. It's very difficult because if you have a classical musician and you want them to be on a talk show, whatever, it's harder and harder to get them booked because not as many people are listening to classical music. So to promote it is really difficult. But what you're doing with your podcast is fantastic because here we're talking about it. We're getting the word out, and you hope that people will be intrigued and they'll take it on themselves to go to YouTube or tune into whatever, however they want to listen. But you hope that they're going to be intrigued enough to listen to classical music. But it's difficult. And these declining audiences are a serious problem. And yeah. I'm an evangelist. You right. see, that's why I wrote my book. I just want everybody to have the most wonderful time and love this music and listen to it. And listen to enough of it so that at one point someone is going to say, I didn't realize how beautiful it is. And I didn't realize that it would make me feel this intensely sentimental, sad, happy, whatever those emotions are. So we're hoping to get the word out and keep these people tuned in and get new people.
Yeah, you always have to get new people. There's no doubt about it. How did you come up with the title, I Knew a Man Who Knew Brahms?
That was my working title. And I use it. I didn't know. I'm not good at titling things. And when I was 18 years old and I was working for the Philadelphia Orchestra, I was working in the library. And I was sharing a table, a desk, with the assistant conductor and the librarian. And one day I was very young, and this very old man walked in. I wouldn't be surprised if he had been in his 90s. And he was very short, bald head, very round glasses. And my boss said, shake this man's hand. So he walked over to my desk and I partly rose and I extended my hand and he clasped my hand and my boss said very dramatically, you are now shaking the hand that shook the hand of Brahms. Well, when you're 18 years old,
that's impressive.
It changes your life. I mean, this was like, you know, I mean, maybe some people would have felt, I'm sure felt that way with Elvis. But that meant a lot to me. And then I asked him how he had known Brahms. And he told me this wonderful story that a very, very famous person in music history, a music critic. And that's where he had met Brahms, in this music critic's apartment in Vienna. It was a great story. So I wrote that. And I liked the rhythm of it. I just thought it was an interesting title because everybody would know that it was about classical music. And there was something about it that appealed to me. So I used it as my working title. And the next thing I know, when I got a publisher, they sent me a contract, and that was the title of the book.
So it worked out. That's very good.
Yeah, and I kind of like it. So.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. We have a couple of minutes left. Well, what for you, and then I'm going to ask you what you want listeners and viewers to take away from reading your book. Again, it's called I Knew a Man Who Knew Brahms, which, of course, Nancy came up with and the publisher agreed, so we're good with that. What was the most impactful episode for you in your memoir? Was there one particular thing?
Yes. And sometimes I cry. Don't be alarmed if I shed a tear or two. But when I was given that free ticket to the Philadelphia Orchestra, I didn't really know what to expect. And when I sat down and I start my book, well, maybe a two pages in, about tuning, because I adore listening to an orchestra tune before a concert. And that moment and that process, people don't listen to it. They'll talk, and then only when the lights begin to dim do they pay attention to the stage. But the tuning process is just phenomenal. It's magical. And So that first time for me, hearing an orchestra, when the orchestra, and I'm talking about in a great concert hall, not an outdoor hall, but at that moment when the orchestra finished tuning and the lights dimmed and the concertmaster walked out, and then the conductor came on stage, turned around, and then it's its own sentence. I said, and then I heard the Philadelphia Orchestra. And that to this day remains unforgettable. It was such a tremendous experience for me. I will never forget that. I hope my memory will always be good.
Well, it's great that there was that singular event that triggered you, if that's the word, but really stuck with you and influenced your life. And that's why you wrote the memoir. There are not a lot of, I think there are a lot of people that don't have a singular event in their life, either as a young person or older, that strikes them that way. So that's a great thing to have, I think, as a way to propel you in your career. How long did it take you to write the book?
That's really, it's a difficult question because I take Sundays. It's almost like 1930 on Sundays in my life because I turn into a Luddite. I have no phone. My phone is off. I make no calls. I don't go online. What else? I just disconnect from the world on Sundays. So I wrote my book basically on Sundays. So I could say that it was over a period of about 10 years. It was a long time, but it was, if it was really on Sundays or on weekends, you have to divide by 6 or 7. But it was a long process because just like in a symphony where every note is important, in a book, in a beautifully written book, every word must be important and it must strike just the right note and the right association. So I wanted this to be very special.
My final question is, of course, what you'd like our viewers and listeners to take away from your book. Is there one or two important points? Or I know they'll enjoy the whole book because I've looked through it. I haven't read it all the way through, but I looked through it and they'll enjoy it. But is there one thing that you want them to take away from reading your book?
Yeah, I do. That no pre-existing knowledge is necessary. You don't have to walk in there and know anything about classical music on a technical basis. You don't have to have any experience. I have referred to the book, and I hope people will accept it in this way, as being a welcomette into the world of classical music. And, you know, this business about, I don't know what to wear to a concert. I don't know when I can cough. Am I allowed to cough during a concert? You know, just relax, come on in, and nobody's going to die if you cough at the wrong place or if you applaud at the wrong place. And if you're concerned about it, wait until everybody else applauds. But this business about having requirements and having to have pre-existing knowledge and experience, no, you don't have to. Come on in.
That's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Nancy Scheer, author of I Knew a Man Who Knew Brahms. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Nancy, go to nancyscheer.com. It's her art service. It's nancyscheer.com. You can read more about her book there as well. Nancy, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Ira. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure. And join us every Thursday for a new Schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.